Stay a while. Stay forever.
Hello, I'm Rob.
And I'm Rob.
And welcome to Impossible Mission. And today we are talking about rather dubious sounding topic, actually. Games for adults.
Yeah. Not the games for adults. Well, not adult games, okay? Just clarifying that there. We're not talking about the, you know, the games where people are in the nud and they're doing all sorts of random things.
Yeah, I wouldn't call them adult thematically, but they're not adult content-wise because you get games like Leisure Suit Larry, and Leisure Suit Larry could never, ever, ever be prescribed as adult game because it's as complicated as boobs.
Well, this is the thing. It's an adult game because of the nudity and the sexual connotation, stuff like that, but we're not talking about those particular games. We're talking about, like, mature games.
Because those games go way back. There's, like, famous examples on the early computer games in which the big point of it was, I think one of them where I can't really talk about this without being, you know, skirting past that sort of level of accessibility and going straight into basically games where sex was the main point of it.
Yeah.
Lots of famous examples, and I'm not going to use the footage from them either because they leave very little to the imagination.
I mean, the thing is, games for adults, this is, historically, games for adults have been things like Leisure Suit Larry. I mean, there was infamously that Playboy game.
I can't remember that one.
That was on like all consoles. That was a game for adults, allegedly. You know, God of War is a game for adults because it's got lots of blood and violence and gore and all sorts. And you replenish health. You replenish your health by going to a brothel.
No, you don't.
Or whatever it was.
You got that completely wrong. There was, I think it was one of the PlayStation 2 or 3 God of War's, PlayStation 3, I think it had been, when there was a bit at the beginning where he was in a pool with a load of buxom wenches, using the parlance of the time, and the camera panned over to the right or the left, and you mashed circle, and the camera would come back into shot, and all the ladies would be out of energy and spent, and you'd get loads of red souls to power up all your weapons.
Oh, that was it, yeah, sorry. I knew you replaced something by doing that.
You just mashed circle, so that's how, yeah, you know, Kratos gets things done.
Mashing the circle. that's a gamer euphemism that never took off, isn't it?
Yeah. But no, I mean, gamers for adults, it's coming from a different aspect, a different approach to what it means for a game to be an adult, I think. That's what we're talking about here. Yeah. You can talk about sort of lewd games, sexual games. There's like a Dave Mirra XXX game. No, it was Dave Mirra Motocross or Motorbiking, sorry.
No, it was BMX XXX.
Yeah. And it wanted to do the XXX game, and he took his name away from it. He didn't want his name associated with it.
Well,
I remember.
No, because he didn't actually get a choice. They went ahead and did it using the Dave Mirra engine without actually telling him.
Oh, no, but they didn't have his name on the game.
No, they didn't have his name on the game, but he basically was not happy with them at all.
No. There was, those games were good back in the day, the Dave Mirra games. And that was kind of a, I'm not playing that. I'm done with that franchise moment.
But that's the thing, though. When people talk about adult games, adult video games, you know, they're always referring to games that have sex or, you know, violence, like extreme violence, stuff like that. But they never really refer to any games that just have a mature storyline, have something that makes you think.
The older example of what a mature game would be, I think the most contemporary example of it would be Saints Row.
Okay.
Saints Row is from that, cut from that cloth as well.
Yeah. Oh, you mean the original Saints Row?
Well, no, the original Saints Row was a normal game.
Yeah.
It was a rather derivative Grand Theft Auto ripoff. Number 2 and number 3, where basically you have like a giant sex aid as a weapon in number 3, I think.
Yeah, the big purple thing, yeah.
Big purple marital aid.
I see where you're going with that one. But I mean, even okay, let's look at Grand Theft Auto. Grand Theft Auto is kind of the elephant in the room here.
Well, it's a good segue game as well.
Yeah, it's a good segue game. But Grand Theft Auto is one of those ones where a lot of people play it for the guns, the violence, the driving around, doing stuff like that.
Well, there's a certain YouTuber who explains it very, very well. He did a video recently, or whatever recently, I don't... Yeah, it was recently, where he's talking about how Naughty Dog games are kind of very reductive when they're trying to sell themselves as very emotional. And he said, there's a type of person in my brain, it's called Goopy Goblin Gamer Brain, which it likes blowing stuff up.
Yeah.
And doing stupid stuff. Nicky Jerky, the YouTuber's called.
Yeah.
The YouTuber on a ball. and it keeps on making you do these other things. It keeps on making you do these story missions that are very basic and derivative. But, well, the core of Grand Theft Auto is the thing that made them the money.
Yeah.
The thing that made them the money is the open world, is the driving a car up to the top of a mountain and, you know, the prostitute aspect of that game where you spend time with one and you get your health back. All sorts of things. Those are the things that made the game, but as those games progressed and Rockstar fought themselves better than their station, and frankly, given that they've probably made about 4 of the top 10 selling games of all time, I think they've probably earned that cockiness. But they started to become a bit more mature with their storytelling.
Yeah.
And the maturity of the storytelling, I mean, number 4 is probably where it really kicked off.
Yeah.
The arc of number 4 was, bah, yuck, it's hard being an immigrant.
Yeah.
That's it. There's little bits in there like, seriously, Roman, stop calling me to go bowling. I don't want to go bowling with you, Roman. Go away.
Well, that's the thing, though. I mean, if you take Grand Theft Auto as an example of how mature ideas, mature concepts can actually be told in video games in a really interesting form, because you can either take on the role of the person who is affected by whatever is happening, or you can take on the role of the person who's doing the affecting.
And number 5.
Yeah.
Keeping the Grand Theft Auto. I don't know whether that has really got any sort of moral to it. I think as far as its moral goes, its crime is bad, but it's also good.
Yeah.
But I think that's as complicated as that one gets.
Yeah. But this is the thing. It doesn't really... With Grand Theft Auto, though, you're still kind of being led around by the nose, by the storylines.
That's what I was getting at when I was opening up. A lot of people just play that game to mess around in the open world.
Yeah.
And that's why you referenced that certain video, the Goopy Goblin Gamer Brain. Yeah. It's just you want to go around blowing cars up.
Yeah, but you don't make your own stories in that game.
No.
You know, you don't make your own story. Let's put it this way. Take the original Walking Dead game from Telltale Games, right? It's basically a glorified point-and-click adventure, but everyone praised it for the storytelling and for the choices that it forced you to make.
Here's the question,
especially
though.
The last one.
Was that game actually that mature, or was it just that last choice was really emotional?
That's where I was about to get to.
Because outside of that, I can't remember anything. Yeah. There's one choice in a shop where you decide whether you save the young woman or the nerdy guy.
Yeah.
That's it.
Yeah.
And there's a bit where you decide whether you take the food out of the boot of the car or not.
Yeah, but the thing is, all those choices, again, at the end of the day, the only thing people remember is that final choice, right? And that isn't a sign of a mature storyline. That's a sign of a really difficult emotional choice, because you basically spent time with these characters. You become invested in the characters. But at the end of the day, you've been led around by the nose into making that choice. So no matter what you choose, it's going to affect you, because the story has led you there. Right.
Yeah, I mean, if you just sort of scan that idea through the rest of the franchise, I haven't played the most recent one, but number 2 and number 3 aren't really anything of anything.
Yeah, but the thing is, you see that same thing happening.
Because it doesn't have that big ending, that big sort of big whammo of the final moment.
But the thing is, you see that exact same situation with storylines, with supposedly mature adult storylines. The exact same scenario happens in game after game after game after game after game after game after game. But then you go to something where you have a completely player-driven system. There is no storyline. There is, you know, there's no narrative. You have a basic idea of what's happening around you, but then everything is on you. Everything is on the people around you. Everything is on the players. Like Eve, yeah?
I knew you were fishing for that. I knew you were going to lead to that.
There's a reason why I'm bringing Eve up, because the players make the stories in Eve. And there's a very big difference between a story created by somebody and a story that's basically created by the situation you're in. I mean, you have stories from Eve that actually make the news now. You have, and I'm not talking about the battles. I'm talking about somebody who's basically got really angry at a corp, who's basically then deleted his character, built a new character, infiltrated the corp, worked his way up over months and years, got to a position of power, and then dismantled the entire corp from the inside.
And you think that's mature?
No, I'm saying that's a revenge plot. And a half, but that's
sorry,
not a revenge plot that someone's come up with. That's a revenge plot that someone's done.
That's
on their
petty.
Own. Yeah, it is. It is. But that's
incredibly childish as well, to be honest.
Yeah, but my point is that, you know, when I see a revenge story in a video game, you know, there's an unbelievability to it because it lacks that pettiness. Revenge is petty.
Context dependent. I'm not going to get into that.
But I'm talking about The Last of Us 2 there, for example.
Yeah, I mean, let's just say right from the off, spoiler warning, in case you've not played The Last of Us 2, we're going to spoil it.
Yeah.
I'd say sort of skip forward a few minutes, so you don't get that spoiled.
Right, okay.
You've been warned, so if you're still listening now and you've not played The Last of Us 2 and it's an issue, spoilers, it's your own bloody fault. So, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. Joe's killed pretty early on by Abby. And then the game switches over to Abby and you see things from her perspective. And then it switches over to Ellie and you see the full picture. And because the whole idea of it is, revenge is bloody and there's two perspectives to it. Because Abby's dad is one of the scientists that Joel kills at the end of the first game.
Yeah.
And that's being heralded. I mean, there's nuance to that. There's aspects to that. There's motherhood and LGBT concerns within the character arc and the character development.
Yeah.
However, that being said, to call that a mature game, which a lot of people have been sort of like talking about, it as like a high watermark for stories that can be told in gaming media, and it takes games past just being games to be emotional, hard stories. It's like, really? Really?
Yeah.
I'm being very reductive, what's that term, reductive ad absurdum or something, here. So, basically, it's the cycle of violence it's talking about, and revenge is bad, and violence is ugly.
Yeah, but...
Them are the core messages of The Last of Us 2. Is that, are those hallmarks of a game that you would describe as a game for adults, or is that just sort of paint by numbers? Numbers, like, maturity, and paint by numbers depth.
Okay, right. I'm just going to take you off the soapbox for a second there.
I have to get that across. So spoilers over now. Spoilers over. Last of Us spoilers gone. Whoop, whoop, gone.
Well, maybe still just a little bit here. The thing is...
Passive spoilers are Last of Us Part 2. Right here.
The thing is, when you look at the revenge plot that you see in video games, it's always super, 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 super serious. Whether it's Red Dead Redemption, or The Last of Us 2, or some other video game, even the Yakuza video games, when they look at revenge, is always super super serious. And Yakuza is a game where that is just completely insane. The whole franchise is, but it's always super serious when it comes to revenge. But as we've said, revenge is petty, right? And that's where it lacks, and that's why it becomes unbelievable. Because what in the minds of the people who are writing these stories, this is a mature storyline because it's so serious, but that's not how life works. And so it becomes unbelievable. People know revenge is petty. And that's why when you see real world revenge, it's always a petty thing. Nobody has the sustained willpower to actually go out and, at some point in The Last of Us 2, when Ellie's forced to make decisions, you know, she wouldn't have been in those positions that she was in, especially when she's in a stable, loving relationship, her opinion would have changed.
Right, here's the question that it comes down to here. Can AAA games be mature? Because in the case of The Last of Us, you have the story and you have the arc, and that's all undone by the fact that you go around killing hundreds of people with really cool gameplay, and it doesn't mean a thing.
Yeah.
They can scream each other's name, they can bleed out in grisly ways, but at the end of the day, it's basically making it fun to slaughter people. So can a game like in that space be mature?
The original Tomb Raider remake did exactly what you just said. Lara Croft never deals with any of the repercussions of killing another human being for the first time. There's no mental health problems, there's no PTSD, nothing. She kills one person, throws up, and then becomes like a god of slaughter.
And the arc is, I really don't want to kill. It's so hard to kill. Please don't make me kill. It's the worst thing I could do as a person. Please don't remove me and rob me of my humanity. 30 minutes later, she's wearing a skin suit out of her enemies.
Yeah, exactly. She's got a necklace. She's got a necklace of ears and, you know.
Yeah.
A headband made of scrotums.
So it's really hard to sort of be this, like, to question the maturity of the character's actions when it's so fun to blow people up. Like Uncharted. Uncharted is a great game. But he's, because from that entire franchise, Nathan Drake's got a kill count which makes Rambo look like a rank amateur. And he never acknowledges it. He never acknowledges the fact that he's killed hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people.
Yeah. Do you know what I find interesting? The new God of War game is one of the few games where you actually are kind of dealing with the repercussions of the character's actions from previous games.
Well, it's not just that. There's a bit where Atreus loses his mind.
Yeah.
And you've killed another character related to this person who you meet.
Yeah.
And Kratos says to Atreus, "No, boy, don't kill him. He's already lost enough. It's not worth it."
Yeah.
Whereas in another game, he'd basically mash in his skull.
Exactly. But this is an older, different Kratos.
It's a mature Kratos.
Yeah.
And I think that's how you do it, really. I think it can be mature in the AAA space, but as far as where we are now, I think Sony Santa Monica Studios are the only one who've really got away with it.
See, I think God of War has hinted at something that I think needs to happen in AAA games, possibly in games in general. Instead of trying to cram the entire storyline into one video game and pad it out as much as you can, take your time. There was no need in The Last of Us 2 to have Abby's story, which is a story in its own right, right?
Yeah, that's kind of like they've mashed in after Last of Us 3 in The Last of Us 2, isn't it?
Exactly. And there's no reason for that, because Abby has a completely different story to Ellie.
Yeah, I mean, The Last of Us 1 is like 12 hours. Last of Us 2 is 30 hours, so...
Yeah. Bringing up an old JRPG on the PS2, right? Shadow Hearts and Shadow Hearts Covenant, yeah?
Yeah.
Now, I've mentioned these briefly a long, long time ago, and I'm a huge fan of Shadow Hearts and Shadow Hearts Covenant. Not so much of Shadow Hearts 3 From the New World, even though it was a continuation of the whole series. But Shadow Hearts and Shadow Hearts Covenant, in the original Shadow Hearts, you are up against this big bad, an English gentleman who wants to use this young girl to conduct a ritual which is supposed to do something, right? Maybe end the world, you don't know. All you know is you have to save the young girl called Alice, right? And I can't remember his name. His name was Simon something, the bad guy. Albert Simon is the bad guy. But then you get onto Shadow Hearts 2, where you've basically, things have happened. I'm not going to, there are spoilers here for Shadow Hearts. So if you haven't played the game and you are intending to play.
Spoilers for Shadow Hearts. Warning. So anyway, warning for about 2 minutes ago. Warning.
Yeah. Yuri, who's the protagonist, he has a problem. He has devil powers, so he turns into different forms of demons, but it's tearing his soul apart. And Alice, the girl who's supposed to be sacrificed, is, you know, she basically heals him, but they fall in love. But then she sacrifices herself at the end of the original game. So Yuri is basically waiting to die at her grave in France at the beginning of during Second World War. And that's when it all starts for Shadow Hearts 2. But that's where you also find out that Albert Simon, the big enemy of the first game, wasn't the big enemy. He was trying to save the world. He just used different methods to you.
Yeah, I don't know if that's what you'd call mature or gaming for adults. I think that's...
No, what I'm saying is an example of splitting up the story but changing the narrative as you go along. Do you see what I mean?
I struggle to think of any game within the space of anime hysteria or RPGs, JRPGs as it otherwise called, which I'd describe as mature or for adults, the kind of skew younger in the very broad strokes.
I don't know. I mean, the Legend of Heroes franchise has some mature narrative elements, but I wouldn't say overall it was a mature storyline. But it does break up the story over a series of games. It doesn't try to cram everything into one game.
But here's the gambit, right? I don't think big studios can shrug off the idea that the AAA games can be for mature audiences as something which is pointless.
Yeah.
Because I think gaming, here's a tangent which also plays in. Gaming is more wide and varied than it's ever been.
Yeah.
Like the audience. But the audience isn't spending their time on games like God of War or whatever mature game you can think of. They're spending the time on the multiplayer space.
Yeah.
So the audience isn't as diverse in this AAA games market where they're playing games about like dad of boy and whatnot. It isn't as diverse in the audience that goes for it.
No.
There's a very specific audience, and you can tell these specific mature storylines of an audience which has grown up with these consoles because the young audience isn't interested in them. The young audience is interested in Rocket League and Fortnite and
whatever the latest Call of Duty thing is. And you're exactly right on that.
A sports game here or a sports game there, whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, a sports game is kind of, you know, that's an all ages thing, but mainly the adult player, the players over a certain age will use those as a wind down thing rather than, you know, as a competitive thing. But mature storylines. See, this is the thing. Going back to God of War. Do you know what I thought of when I started playing God of War? The first thing that popped into my head was No Country for Old Men.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. It is. Has that vibe to it.
And it's such a similar vibe. And I was surprised to feel that from a video game that I hadn't felt like that for a long time. You know, matching a video game up to a movie.
There's also indie games that work within this sort of mature space, but I don't think, when I think of a game for adults.
Yeah.
I don't think of a game like, no, Papers, Please, that makes me question the choices of immigration. That's not really a game for adults in the same way. It's more of like it just asks you a question.
Yeah.
Of how you look at the world. And that's it.
I'd say that's a mature game, you know. But
not in the same way, though.
I'd say it's a mature game, but not in the same way. I think it's something that allows you to focus on a specific thing. But if it was in a AAA game, it'd simply be one aspect of an overall, you know, mature theme. Do you see what I mean? That whole bit of Papers, Please, where you're deciding the immigration bit. There'd be an overarching narrative in a AAA game. You know, you would have your character would have a life and a family. You'd see the effects of war and stuff like that. You'd see the effects your choices are making on people who you've let into the country or people who have been, you know, who you've stopped at the border. There'd be a wider viewpoint in a AAA game. It wouldn't be so narrowly enclosed on just your job there and then, would it?
No, it'd be a bit more diverse. Yeah, I mean, it's come back to this point that I've talked about before. You know, video games are at this point now where they know what their audience is.
Yeah.
And this whole idea of trying to appeal to all, like, a AAA game is basically shorthand for it's for everybody.
But it's not. That's the thing.
The AAA market is pretty specific, I'd say. And it's got to this point now where games have got to start growing up because they can't. I mean, to use the superhero movie sort of analogy, they've got to start making more Logans,
yeah,
and less Deadpool 2s.
I mean, there's still a place for Deadpool, but you know, you need that serious storytelling. You need that serious through line going through everything in order to retain your audience, because your audience isn't kids. Your audience for AAA games are the ones who can afford the AAA games. Usually people with jobs, people who have families, people who basically want to play a good story.
Yeah. And I think this next generation, the PlayStation 5, Xbox One, and whatever Nintendo does next.
Yeah.
And PC, which is kind of just omnipresent over a lot of them. Games need to start being a bit more specific about the fact that the people who play their games aren't teenagers. This whole idea of the gamer is some 12-year-old in their mum's basement with the joystick and having their friends over and going to the arcade, that sort of stereotype is dead.
Yeah. See, right.
Now, but the thing is, gaming is now, it's the biggest medium on the planet.
Yeah.
And it's basically as diverse in the story as it tells as the MCU. I'm not bashing on the MCU. I love that franchise. But at the same time, they're all kind of the same thing at the end of the day.
Yeah.
And video games are the same. But the medium has to acknowledge the fact that video games are the biggest entertainment medium on the planet. And so the titles that get made and produced have to reflect that.
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question. Right. I'm going to just go through certain games, and I want you to tell me, is this game a mature game or not? Or is it a game that's kind of all ages, for teenagers, okay, whatever? Persona 5.
A little bit of both. It tries to be mature, but the way it handles it is kind of ham-fisted. The fact it got in trouble for its gay stereotype, abusive gay stereotype, just tells it intends well, but it failed.
Okay. The Witcher 3.
Yeah, that's a game for adults.
Okay. Resident Evil 2, the remake.
It's just, no, not really. It's not a game for adults. It's a game for adults in the sense of it's really graphic and gory, but that doesn't make it adult.
Yeah.
It's kind of all, it's for everybody, you know.
Yeah.
But it's really grisly, so you can't. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Metal Gear Solid 5.
Yeah, I don't even know what that is. It's garbage.
Dark Souls 3.
That's for everybody.
Yeah.
The patient subsect of everybody. I'm not one of those. So.
Okay. Nier Automata.
Yeah, that's for kids.
Yeah.
I hate to call it that because it's anime, but yeah.
Ghost of Tsushima.
I don't know enough about that, but given what I do know, it's basically just a revenge trip within an Assassin's Creed style game in feudal Japan, but very, very beautiful.
Okay.
Kind of for everybody. Everybody, really.
Okay. Dishonored 2.
It skews a bit older.
Yeah. But okay, I think Neo 2 then.
That's the same thing, Rob.
Dishonored 2 and Neo 2.
All right, I was getting confused there. Yeah, Neo 2 is kind of in the same gap as Dark Souls, isn't it?
Okay.
But it's anime-fied, so it's probably even more skewing a bit younger, you know.
Battlefield 1.
Are you approaching this as a multiplayer or as a...
Either.
I don't know, honestly. I mean, the single player is definitely for adults because it has some sort of concept of the futility of life in war.
Yeah.
But, again, it's the multiplayer. You can say all these nice things in the single player, but boom, make people go boom, boom, it's fun. It kind of undermines it all, doesn't it?
Okay, and now the curveball, right? Hellblade, Senua's Sacrifice.
Yeah, that's a game for adults. I don't think that's a curveball at all. I think that's pretty obvious what that is. That's a game intended for adults. It's about sort of mental health.
No, the reason I say it's a curveball is because every other title I've listed there was a AAA title, wasn't it?
Yeah, I guess it was, yeah. Yeah, but it's totally a game for adults, Hellblade.
And the entire approach, introspective, dealing with PTSD and other mental health issues. There's all sorts going on in Hellblade that you have to kind of pick away at and decipher while you're playing the game and afterwards. It's a lot to think about. And, you know, I used the example of Papers, Please, where it was, you know, in a AAA game, it would just be one aspect of a wider game. Hellblade is kind of an example of what I was talking about.
Well, Papers, Please would be a mini game.
It'd be a mini game, but the thing is, it'd be an important mini game within the wider construct of a game about immigration and border control and stuff like that.
It'd be like hacking is in Watch Dogs. It'd play that much of a central role.
Yeah, and in Hellblade, I've seen elements of Hellblade in indie games, you know, where it's been like the central element of an indie game, but it's become part of what made up Hellblade and made Hellblade such a special game. Because I do regard Hellblade as a very, very special, very mature game. Because of what it tries to do. And it's interesting to me that it was, you know, it's not a AAA game.
Well, it was a high AAA value in an indie package.
Yeah.
So that is mature. That's mature and adult games. If you've got anything to add, even if it's just to call me out on my horse crap, please do comment below and join our conversation. I'd love to hear from you.
Hi, this is Private Dick Simmons from the popular web series Red vs. Blue, and you're listening to The Geek Show. Sarge approved.
I'm Graham Williamson, and I like films starring pop stars. I like films about pop stars. I like films which have set design by pop stars. Probably gone a bit far there, I can't actually think of one of those. Anyway, this is why I've launched The Geek Show's new podcast, Pop Screen, where every week, me and a guest host take a look at one film, either starring by or about a pop star, and by pop I could mean anything from heavy metal to blues to disco to hip-hop, and we analyse it relentlessly, asking all of the big questions.
Ewan, who's your favourite Spice Girl?
Oh no. Can I say Richard E. Grant's my favourite Spice Girl?
And even giving some of the big answers with our unparalleled level of research and nerdishness.
I'm definitely a Beatles fan. I was on a Beatles tour taxi in Liverpool with my family, and the tour guide started referring to me for little details and to double check his facts.
So whether you're an absolute beginner or a 24-hour party person, get swept away. I'll stop doing this now, I promise. By Pop Screen, the new podcast from the Geek Show Podcast Network. It's about music, it's about movies, it's about nonsense. We're hosted on Audioboom and available on your podcast provider of choice, as well as the Geek Show's YouTube channel. Remember to like and subscribe.
Perplexed by the pompous, ponderous piffle purveyed by normal art critics? Well, you've come to the right place, because we're not normal. We take a not-so-serious look at the serious worlds of art and literature. Join Sarah, Andrew, Rob and Graham for a piffle-free journey through the cultural landscape of the 21st century. Literary loitering. Because you can't make a cultural omelette without smashing a few eggheads.
Today we're talking about something which, on the face of it, might sound a bit sort of pretentious, a bit sort of behind the curtain. And the word you use is aesthetics. This is following on from something that we were discussing on a recent edition of the sister show of this, Monthly Games Marmalade. Essentially, it's just that the episode title is Aesthetics, Art Design versus Photorealism.
The first bite is with the eye. As with food, you know, so with video games. First bite is with the eye. The first thing that you see with a video game is the trailer or something like that. And you think, okay, I really want to play that game, but do you want to play it because of the way it looks or because, you know, because the action's got you excited? You know, usually it's the way it looks that gets people going, isn't it?
Well, yes, mostly. But the reason why I think this is an interesting talking point, a relevant talking point, is because the next generation has launched, so PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X are out now. And the next generation's usually, like, the big thing about that is the graphics. I don't think that's the case this time, but we've got episodes talking about that in the past.
Yeah.
So it gets to the point, photorealism has, like, a limit.
Yeah. Yes, it does.
And we're seeing a rise of games where art direction are much more important. But for me, honestly, I don't think photorealism is all it's made out to be.
Well, it's as we've said in other episodes, and I know it's slightly repeating myself here, your eye can only handle so much information, your brain can only process so much information. So people talk about resolution and graphical fidelity and frames per second and stuff like that. But after a certain point, it becomes irrelevant, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that aspect to it. Obviously, there's the human's capabilities to take in information. Obviously, that's a part of it. But I don't think that's the most immediate thing. the most immediate thing for me is going back to that idea of what a game looks like. How much variation can you get when all you're trying to do is imitate reality? Because once you imitate reality and you've got to a certain point of technology and a capability of being able to put what looks like a real person into a video game, there's only one way people look. You know, discounting raid, creed, place in the world, nationality, skin colour, all that sort of stuff. But people kind of all look the same. So once that breakthrough's been made, there's no room for sort of variation. You can't have different interpretations of photorealism. Photorealism is photorealism. It's one thing. There's no wiggle room on it. So what I'm basically saying here is, once games essentially attain this mystical idea of being photoreal, everything will look exactly the same.
Yeah, I kind of get what you mean. And when you say everything will look exactly the same, right?
I'm not exaggerating either. I'm being literal.
No. But this is the thing. When you say everything will look exactly the same, I hate to say it, but it's going... In a very real sense, that will be the case. It will generally be a Caucasian protagonist of some sort.
Well, that's changing, but
but generally it'll be a Caucasian protagonist of some sort. They will have a fighter's build of some sort so that they can handle any action that comes along. They will have it's one of the reasons why I'm looking forward to Watch Dogs Legion, is the fact that you got different characters who can become part of the Legion, and they'll come in different sizes, shapes, colours.
The character models are garbage, though, but yeah, that's fair.
But, you know, Watch Dogs Legion is one of the rare games where you have multiple characters of multiple ethnicities and multiple body shapes. And why can't you have a video game, a photorealistic video game, where, you know, it's basically an unfortunate fat guy who gets pushed into matters beyond his control? It happens in films. Why can't it happen in video games?
No, I mean, the thing that isn't really discussed about photorealism is when you're basically creating a game which looks like real life, you're basically saying, I can't do this sort of thing anymore. You can't make certain types of scene. You can't make certain topics of game. And some of the things which happen in horror, some of the grotesque gore, it's in horror movies. But horror movies and games are very much different. A horror movie is a passive activity. A gore game is active. You're actively causing this gore. So it'll kickstart a load of new arguments about censorship in video games. Let's take like a Disaster Zone game. If a Disaster Zone game is photorealism, is that supremely bad taste?
Probably yes.
So, it being realistic, you basically set video games up to be like the same sort of questions asked about it as anything else would.
Yeah, but I mean, there's also the aspect of creativity when you get down to it.
That's going back to what we're saying, though, isn't it? Once you get photorealism, it's all like, identical.
Well, kind of. Yeah, I mean, you can still be creative with photorealism, but the problem is that generally with video games, what we've seen so far, and I'm not going to judge the future of video game photorealism, but what we've seen so far is thinking pressed right up against the outside of the box, you know, wanting to be inside the box but not. That's how designers have been with photorealism. So they may give a character some stubble or maybe a broken nose here and there, maybe they're missing half an ear, but that's the limit of it, you know. You won't actually go any further than that in terms of creating a character, in terms of creating a lead character or a supporting character or something like that in a video game. They will always be of a specific mold and they'll always look a certain way, right? But then you've got it's the difference between say impressionism and portraiture. Okay. When artists were doing portraiture, when they had people sitting in front of them, and I think any still life art class across any country will actually demonstrate this in its entirety. You can have a character, you can have a person sitting in front of you in the nude, as they usually do in still life art classes, and you'll have a group of people, you know, drawing that character. But what you'll see from each person is a different approach to drawing that person. Some will be impressionistic, some will go for abstraction, and each person will have a different approach to that particular character. And that's where the creativity comes in. And I think that's what's missing from you know, the design elements of a lot of these video game studios where they go solely for photorealism.
But to return to that point, I honestly don't believe there's that much photorealism.
Well,
not genuine. Gamers try to look more authentic.
Yeah.
They try to be a bit more realistic.
Yeah.
But realism, like proper photorealism, beside things in a person's face, like bags under their eyes, grey hairs in the beard with Kratos or something like that, it's rare.
Yeah. But, I mean, that's what I mean when I was talking about creativity. But at the end of the day, if you want photorealism, just hire some actors and video it. You know,
yeah, that is actually starting again, though, isn't it? Those games are basically actors that you tell
the FMV thing is. I thought the FMV craze had died a death.
Yeah, there was Her Story was one. Erica is another.
Was it Man of Medan was another one?
No, that's proper graphics. That one
is that proper graphics.
But Her Story was like the big sort of. Hang on, they're still doing this stuff, and it got a lot of Game of the Year awards. That one too.
Yeah, and I was surprised because all I can remember from FMVs are things like The Seventh Guest and Phantasmagoria and Night Trap, the dreaded Night Trap.
Yeah, but it was like through filters and filters and filters there, so it looked like it was shot on grease rather than a camera.
Yeah.
But art direction is much more all-encompassing with video games.
Yeah.
There's certain video games which are sort of photorealism and sort of art direction when you get into sort of like the big AAA space.
Yeah.
Uncharted skews a bit more towards photorealism, whereas GTA skews a little bit more towards art direction. Yeah. But there's in that sort of top end of video games where it's like hundreds of millions of pounds to make it, there's a little bit of both. And to return to that point I was making earlier, one, they can all look the same, and two, it's very indistinct.
Well, the bizarre thing is that when you're talking about photorealism and art direction in games, a rare type of game where photorealism, you don't think it matters, but it kind of does. I wouldn't say a rare type of game. A type of game that you wouldn't normally think of. Racing games, right?
Yeah.
If you think of something like Forza Horizon,
but when you think of photorealism, you think of human faces, don't you?
Yeah, but this is exactly my point. A lot of people think of human faces, but when you're talking about a racing game, right? Say, take Forza Horizon 4. One of the reasons why I really enjoyed playing that game is because the environment, the photorealistic environment, was, you know, you had little animals, you had little creatures, you had, branches and twigs that snapped and stayed snapped. You know, you had all sorts of different things happening in the environment around you. And sometimes you could pay attention to them, you know, when the race is starting, you can look around and you can see what's going on. When you're driving, if you're driving at a decent pace, you can see what's going on. And it all looks really, really beautiful, you know, mirroring the real world in a very, very big way. And I remember when Sega Rally Championship originally came out, right, and things like Daytona USA and stuff like that, and the blocky graphics, you know, the 16-bit graphics and everything like that. And even at that point, they were still aspiring for photorealism, because I remember in the Sega Rally Championship, you had little things like squirrels that had run out of the way.
Well, that's just detail, isn't it, in production value?
Yeah, detail and production value, but erring on the side of photorealism, even with 16-bit graphics, trying to aim for something that mirrored real life.
With sports games, I think that's okay, though.
Yeah, with sports games, I think it's okay. I think with games like FIFA and that, obviously you buy them because you want to play as your favourite players.
Yeah, but the thing about games like FIFA is the photorealism only extends as long as they really care to. Yeah. You can play as, I don't know, Real Madrid, and all the players look exactly like they're supposed to. You play as Wickham Wanderers,
yeah,
and nobody looks like anybody.
Yeah.
So, on one hand, it's, oh my God, that looks so much like player X. Don't follow football as much as you used to. But you play against a low league team, and, you know, nothing.
Yeah.
It's just basically generic faces, a sea of generic faces.
I remember in FIFA when after you got past a certain point of a career mode, you'd get all these new characters being created. You know, 17-year-old was so-and-so, and all you'd have is just this silhouette. There's no face on it.
Yeah, yeah, you do get that. It's like a mysterious person rather than somebody who you've bought and who's in your team.
Exactly.
But that direction is much more important, I think. Sports games, yeah, it's there, but as is the case, you know, art direction is what you remember. Art direction doesn't just come to presentation, it also comes in sort of story beats and things that you include in the game.
Yeah, I mean...
Just on that point, photorealism is realism. Art direction is exaggeration, is over-the-topness, is larger than life.
See, this is the thing, right? Call of Duty, Battlefield, whatever, versus a game like Splatterhouse, yeah?
Can you do it a bit more, like, where they have something in common? Because those two games, basically, you may as well be comparing apples and oranges.
I am comparing apples and oranges, but there is a point... All right, what was it? Was it Sniper? No, it wasn't Sniper Elite. Was it Sniper Elite, where you had the slow-motion shots?
Yeah, Sniper Elite or Zombie Army, yeah.
Sniper Elite and Zombie Army versus Splatterhouse, then, right? On one side, you've got a game which is kind of angling towards photorealism, but isn't quite there, but has these gorgeous slow-motion shots of you killing zombies or people, you know, the bullet striking the skull and exploding, blah, 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 blah. And you see it all in slow motion, yeah?
Yeah.
And on the other side, you've got Splatterhouse, where you're basically running around hitting things with a baseball bat or a chainsaw.
Yeah, the other one where you're basically using something's limb to beat another person to death.
On one side, you've got very kind of cartoonish violence. On the other side, you've got something that's erring towards photorealistic violence. Yeah. And do you know what? One of them I can live with. One of them I can only play it for so long before I start getting really uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's going back to that thing I was talking about earlier with the certain things you can and can't do when you're going for photorealism. I wouldn't describe this game as photorealistic in the way it looks, but in the way it plays, yeah. But Manhunt. Manhunt was controversial for all of the right reasons. Yes, most famously, you could kill somebody with a plastic bag. I'm not using footage for this, by the way. I refuse to use footage of Manhunt. But, yeah, that's the sort of fine line you tread when you're trying to be realistic. If you're trying to be realistic, you can't have a realistic game and have people flying dragons and doing, like, super energy punches.
Yeah, it just don't work. But then again, Final Fantasy games are aiming towards photorealism these days, which
is... more photorealistic, not photorealism.
Well, photorealistic, yeah. But it's a very stylistic photorealism, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it's not in a time that we can relate to, is it?
It's not in a time we can relate to, and I've noticed that, I think Conan O'Brien said it best about Final Fantasy 15. Everyone looks like they're in a K-pop band.
Yeah, so that's a kind of reality. Not ours. But it's a kind of reality.
It's some weird reality which we've not been invited to.
Yeah, but indie games are sort of the elephant in the room because that's where I think art direction is at its most diverse.
Yeah, and I think that when you get games like Unfinished Swan, right, where the world is revealed through ink.
Yeah.
You know, it's a very simplistic kind of graphical style, but the approach was... You know, the approach was something else, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, going even more basic than that, take 16-bit graphics, which are always referred to as 8-bit incorrectly.
Yeah.
Now, they're doing way more with that than they ever could before.
Yeah.
It's way more expressive, there's way more imagination, whereas before, 16-bit and 8-bit graphics were sort of a technological problem. They couldn't do anything better, so that's what you had to have.
Yeah.
Now you can implement... Like, technology is much more advanced into something which looks older. So you get much more creative and interesting games.
Absolutely. I mean, when you look at other indie games, like, I've commented on how I think Bastion is one of the most beautiful indie games. Just for the sheer level of colour and diversity that's on show.
I never really got Bastion being called beautiful, but, you know, each to their own.
Different angle then? Firewatch. Firewatch has some of the most stunning kind of scenery snapshots I've seen.
Oh, yeah. I mean, all the characters look like they were basically designed by, well, what you see of them, by Hanna-Barbera with the big sort of block hands.
Yeah.
You look like Fred Flintstone with his hands going around being a Firewatch guy.
Yeah, but the scenery in Firewatch is just stunning. I mean,
so that's a weird one, which sort of, kind of example country where we talk about sort of AAA games being all about sort of a little bit of art design, a little bit of photorealism. That's in indie games.
Yeah.
You could say the same of Hellblade too.
Yeah, but I think Hellblade, okay, Hellblade was kind of was one of those indie games made by a AAA developer.
No, it wasn't.
It was Ninja Theory, wasn't it?
No, they weren't.
Was it Ninja Theory?
They made a big fuss, made a big promotional push out of the fact that they're a, what was the term? It was a double A indie.
Double A indie.
Yeah, it was like a double A game. It was a triple A game with indie budget. That was the whole sort of marketing push behind it.
Yeah.
I don't think Ninja Theory were ever really AAA. They were always in that sort of mid-ground, but, yeah.
Okay, so what about a game like, I don't know, Persona or something like that?
Well, that's totally an anime, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's a different art style. It's not photorealism in any way, shape or form, but, you know, art direction?
Well, it's anime, isn't it?
It's anime, but, I mean...
And unless there's been anime, like a movement, unless there's been a movement in anime where they suddenly become all photoreal, I've missed a lot since bowing out of that genre. That's not happened, has it?
No, it hasn't. Thankfully, well, no, they attempted with a couple of CG movies that I can name, but thankfully, well, the mech battles in those CG movies were great. The rest of the movies weren't.
Yeah, but anime is a big thing, isn't it? Which opens up another question, art direction and style.
Yeah.
Because as it's becoming increasingly common, really, you're getting, especially in the indie game space, you're getting a lot of American-produced indie games which have an anime style.
Yeah.
Which I've always felt curious, you know. There was one, I can't remember what it was called, but it was basically a dating simulator about an arcade. I can't remember its name.
Arcade Spirits?
That might be it, yeah. Valhalla, that was another one. There's a new one about running a coffee shop. I can't remember the name of that one, which is, I think it's Dutch made and it's got an anime art direction.
Yeah. And you see the anime style a lot in indie games, and you see a lot of anime centric games on the PlayStation has a lot of them, and they basically kept the Vita alive for a long time.
Hmm.
But you do, you know, you are starting to get games like Gravity Rush, which are really coming to the fore. They've got an anime type styling, but I wouldn't say it was anime specifically.
And to go with Nier more than Gravity Rush. Gravity Rush didn't really get the success it deserved.
Yeah, well, Nier and Nier Automata are very anime-esque games. I wouldn't say that they were anime type games specifically, but. I think because they're basically taking their cues from anime in general, they're anime-esque more than anything else.
Here's an interesting conundrum that I just thought up, and it's probably wrong because I've just rushed it out. But have you noticed how Western games tend to be a bit more real and Eastern tend to be a bit more unreal?
Actually, that's true. That is very, very true. It's not really a conundrum. I think one of the reasons for that is... Well, I think it has to do with when it comes to stories and stuff like that. Over in the East, they're not afraid to borrow things from other countries, right? Whereas I think we in the West are a bit more reserved about doing things like that.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Well, it makes sense entirely, because if you look at movies, the amount of blatant rip-offs from China and Japan in the 70s and 80s, it's blatantly obvious that they weren't really interested in being tasteful about where they take things from.
Yeah, but I mean, if you take your average fantasy game, right? Your average fantasy game from any console at any point, right? Just pick any The Witcher, right? The Witcher is a great example, right? So in The Witcher, it's kind of medievalish time, just maybe post-medieval time.
Middle Ages.
Yeah, Middle Ages, you got castles, you got cobbled streets, everyone's riding horses, maybe horse and cart, you know, people wearing armour, wielding swords, yada, 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 right? So, if you go across to the East, you think, okay, fantasy game from the East should be, you know, Eastern-style castles and Eastern-style streets and Eastern-style costumes. Well, what do you get? You get... medieval castles, medieval cobbled streets, people riding horses, wielding swords. So basically, the only difference between The Witcher and, say, this something like Dragon Quest is the art style.
Yeah.
In terms of the actual setting, the only difference is the art style. You won't get a Western developer going, I'm going to make an Eastern game.
With the exception of Ghost of Tsushima, but yeah.
With the exception of Ghost of Tsushima and maybe Nioh.
Nioh's a Japanese produced. It's Team Ninja, isn't it? So that was Sucker Punch. Yeah, I think they're in Seattle.
Yeah, but they did have a lot of Japanese input to make that game.
Well, if they did or if they didn't, either are. But the point is, yeah, they're doing something which is completely different, I guess.
We don't tap into, say, Japanese folklore or Korean folklore or Chinese folklore to make games here in the West. Whereas over in Japan and China and Korea, they'll happily tap into Western folklore to make games. They'll happily tap into Western history and Western environments and stuff like that to make games. We don't.
Yeah, I want to wrap this up with a question, though.
Yeah?
If you had to pick a game that had your favourite use of art direction, what is it? A game which has the best use of photorealism, what is it?
Now you're asking. See, art direction and photorealism, I mean, if I was going to pick one that kind of combined both...
Well, I'd allow it, but you still need to pick a second one of the other.
I will, but kind of art direction and photorealism, one that kind of combined both was Bioshock Infinite.
I don't see the photorealism. I don't see the photorealism there.
There is a degree of photorealism in there in terms of the actual environments, the physics, that sort of thing. But the art direction, would you agree the art direction was there?
Yeah, it's kind of cartoony, isn't it? Big eyes and...
Yeah.
And flying chicken men with guns. Yeah, I've got that game wrong. But it'll do.
Photorealism... Oh. Come back to me on the photorealism one.
Art direction for me, it's a weird one, really, because there's so many different ways you can approach it. I really like the cartoon aesthetic of a lot of games. This thing which has become really prominent over the last couple of years, hand-painted stuff. Cuphead. There's never been a game like Cuphead. Cuphead is stunning for all of the right reasons. That is pure aesthetic, pure art design. But I'm not going to pick that. I'm going to pick Akami.
Ooh, good call.
Because Akami is a Japanese 14th century watercolour.
Yeah.
And that's way pretentious. Like, incredibly pretentious to even say what it is. But as an art style, as a direction, it's so singular. And the gameplay plays into this art direction with you not using swords or martial arts or anything. You use like swipes of, I'm assuming it's Amaterasu's tail to paint calligraphy.
Yeah.
So it's kind of an all-consuming art direction in that game, which is stunning and unique. And once you've seen it, you'll never, ever forget a game like that.
They tried to mimic that in Epic Mickey, didn't they?
Yeah, really. The whole idea of it,
it didn't work that well.
As for photorealism with me, though, I don't think I've been impressed by photorealism ever. Because, like, I opened this episode up by talking about once you hit it, it all looks the same. There's no real flair beyond sort of technical nous in photorealism.
I'm going to change my answer. You've just made me think of two very different ones.
But photorealism, let's see. I think you have to go with a racing game, though, really, don't you? I really like what they're doing with the rally games. The modern rally games over at Codemasters, the Dirts, and... It's just racing games in general, the current iteration of racing games. There was a point previously where realism in racing games was, look how shiny that car is.
Yeah.
It had lots of shiny. And as the race went on, it got less shiny. And realism, graphics.
I remember when they used to do the trailers for those racing games, it was always, look how shiny the car is. Shiny.
Yeah. But now it seems like it's much more of, it looks like it could be looking out the window.
Yeah. I want to change my answer.
And that's the only way I think photorealism works, when it's something mechanical like that. But yeah, you're a new answer.
Yeah, my new two answers. One is photorealism, the other is art direction. Totally, right? And this is, you've just made me think of them. Number one, it's more to do with the environment than the character models, but Sleeping Dogs.
Okay.
The environment of Hong Kong in Sleeping Dogs is stunning.
It's dated a little bit, though.
dated a little bit, but the level of detail they went into, I mean, they basically copied what they did when they made Shenmue. They went around Hong Kong with cameras and basically took photos of everything.
Yeah, recently finished Sleeping Dogs and all the DLC, and I was really disappointed to learn that the game company's gone under.
Yeah.
United Front Games. Because that's a fun
they
game.
They put in a massive amount of work for that game.
Yeah, it deserved better.
And, yeah, but Sleeping Dogs is... the environment in Sleeping Dogs is just stunning.
Are you using that as a photoreal?
Yeah, photorealism.
Okay.
Yeah, and art direction. Bizarrely, I'm going to have to go back to the PS2 just like you, because as soon as you mentioned Okami, I thought, there is a game from the PS2 which has stunning art direction, and people don't realise that it does.
Go on.
Dark Chronicle.
Does it?
Yeah.
My memory, that's worse than I thought then. Because I thought it was just sort of generic anime game.
See, that's the thing. A lot of people pass it off. A lot of people look at it and pass it off as generic anime game. But Dark Chronicle has some amazing art direction in there.
Okay.
And think about the enemies you face. Think about the different things that you can do in that game. And you're basically an inventor with a giant spanner, wrench.
Is that the one where you got to rebuild your village? Or was
you
that Dark Cloud?
A village. That, well, it was in Dark Cloud and Dark Chronicle. Same mechanic in both games, and you can travel backwards and forwards in time to see what it looked like in the future.
Yeah. Interesting choice. I wouldn't have went with it, but that doesn't make it wrong.
One of the reasons I've gone with Dark Chronicle is because just the... the camera wasn't perfect in it, but the actual stylistic choices, they were bizarre and weird and just really captured the whole idea of... you just living in this and exploring this strange world that you hadn't really looked at before.
Yeah.
It's not like the Final Fantasy games where you'll have certain static things, which, you know, you'll have certain static enemies in every Final Fantasy game. You'll have an adamantage, you'll have bombs, you'll have coils, or however you pronounce that stupid name. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah, it's all sort of well-worn. Trucks.
Yeah, you've basically been through all of these different creatures before, and yeah, they might look fancier and more photorealistic than before, but it's still the creature that you've fought in other games.
Yeah, you're still fighting a giant cactus.
Yeah.
A giant dancing cactus.
Yeah. It's like Dragon Quest and the Slimes. Dragon Quest and the Slimes is a common thing.
Yeah. So I think they're doing a pretty good count there, you know. Art direction is pretty more important going forward, but you know, photorealism is important too.
Well, I think one of the things is that I would love to see a photorealistic game where the developers have actually tried to mimic something like synesthesia.
Hmm. You're gonna have to explain that, Rob.
Well, you know how synesthesia is that thing where your senses don't work the way they should.
Yeah. Yeah.
So things like you can taste colours and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just one of these concepts. You can't just drop it and not explain yourself.
No, I'm just saying that it would be interesting to see a photorealistic game that tried to mimic synesthesia to a degree.
Yeah, you know? Yeah, of course, yeah. What you're saying is a game that represents something that's real which we can never experience.
Yeah, basically. And I think that's the next step for photorealism in games, is trying to do stuff that we would never be able to experience in real life.
Yeah, instead of just, ooh, pretty shiny, or ooh, green.
Yeah, or brown. Brown is the other big one.
Yeah, which it currently is. Or, ooh, wrinkles. Oh. Ooh, slowly realizing that you're getting older. But yes, on that.
Why is it that you only have games like Fable, which have cartoonish characters, and that you get the whole concept of a character growing old over the course of the game?
Well, we'll see. I think it's one of those sort of Arrested Development things, isn't it?
Yeah, but, you know.
Is what it is.
Yeah. If you've liked the video, then give us a thumb, a sub, or a bell. And if you want to support us, then check out our Patreon. The details are in the description below.
That's all from Impossible Mission this week, though. Join us every Thursday for more video game chit-chat. Until next time, it's goodbye from me.
And it's goodbye from me.